science and believed instead that it was the final ritual promotion to a higher form of life. This meant, too, that invisible spirits of the dead had power over the living, and if someone died prematurely, it was thought to be the result of malevolent spirits or the breach of taboos. Premature death did not come as an impersonal accident. This reasoning meant that primitive man put the highest priority on ways to avoid bad will and bad action, which is why he seems to have circumscribed his activities in often compulsive and phobic ways. Tradition has laid a heavy hand over men everywhere. Utopian man might live in the same eternal now of the primitives, but undoubtedly too with the same real compulsivity and phobia. Unless one is talking about real immortality, one is talking merely about an intensification of the character defenses and superstitions of man. Curiously, Harrington himself seems to sense this, when he speculates on what kind of gods the Utopians would worship. The children of eternity may worship variations of luck, or that which cannot be controlled. Luck will be the only thing that can kill them, and for this reason, they may go down on their knees before it. They may conduct ceremonies before the future equivalent of a giant slot machine or roulette wheel. Some godlike creatures. The fallacy in all this sterile utopianism is that fear of death is not the only motive of life. Heroic transcendence, victory over evil for mankind as a whole, for unborn generations, consecration of one's existence to higher meanings. These motives are just as vital, and they are what give the human animal his nobility, even in the face of his animal fears. Hedonism is not heroism for most men. The pagans in the ancient world did not realize that, and so lost out to the despicable creed of Judeo-Christianity. Modern men equally do not realize it, and so they sell their souls to consumer capitalism or consumer communism, or replace their souls, as Rank said, with psychology. Psychotherapy is such a growing vogue today because people want to know why they are unhappy in hedonism and look for the faults within themselves. Unrepression has become the only religion after Freud, as Philip Reif so well argued in a recent book. Evidently, he did not realize that his argument was an updating and expansion of exactly what Rank had maintained about the historical role of psychology. The limits of psychotherapy. As we have already covered this problem in Chapter 4, where we first broached the dilemma of life, let us refresh our memories here. We saw that there really was no way to overcome the real dilemma of existence, the one of the mortal animal who at the same time is conscious of his mortality. A person spends years coming into his own, developing his talent, his unique gifts, perfecting his discriminations about the world, broadening and sharpening his appetite, learning to bear the disappointments of life, becoming mature, seasoned, finally, a unique creature in nature, standing with some dignity and nobility and transcending the animal condition, no longer driven, no longer a complete reflex, not stamped out of any mold. And then the real tragedy, as André Malraux wrote in The Human Condition, that it takes 60 years of incredible suffering and effort to make such an individual, and then he is good only for dying. This painful paradox is not lost on the person himself, least of all himself. He feels agonizingly unique, and yet he knows that this doesn't make any difference as far as ultimates are concerned. He has to go the way of the grasshopper, even though it takes longer. We said that the point was that even with the highest personal development and liberation, the person comes up against the real despair of the human condition. Indeed, because of that development, his eyes are open to the reality of things. There is no turning back to the comforts of a secure and armored life. The person is stuck with the full problem of himself, and yet he cannot rely on himself to make any sense out of it. For such a person, as Camus said, the weight of days is dreadful. What does it mean, then, we questioned in Chapter 4, to talk fine-sounding phrases like being cognition, the fully centered person, full humanism, the joy of peak experiences, or whatever, unless we seriously qualify such ideas with the burden and the dread that they also carry? Finally, with these questions, we saw that we could call into doubt the pretensions of the whole therapeutic enterprise. What joy and comfort can it give to fully awakened people? Once you accept the truly desperate situation that man is in, you come to see not only that neurosis is normal, but that even psychotic failure represents only a little additional push in the routine stumbling along life's way. If oppression makes an untenable life livable, self-knowledge can entirely destroy it for some people. Rank was very sensitive to this problem and talked about it intimately. I would like to quote him at length here in an unusually mature and sober psychoanalytic reflection that sums up the best of Freud's own stoical world picture. A woman comes for consultation. What's the matter with her? She suffers from some kind of intestinal symptoms, painful attacks of some kind of intestinal trouble. She had been sick for 8 years and has tried every kind of physical treatment. She came to the conclusion it must be some emotional trouble. She is unmarried. She is 35. She appears to me, and admits it herself, as being fairly well adjusted. She lives with a sister who is married. They get along well. She enjoys life, goes to the country in the summer. She has a little stomach trouble. Why not keep it, I tell her? Because if we are able to take away those attacks that come once in a fortnight or so, we do not know what problem we shall discover beneath it. Probably this defense mechanism is her adjustment. Probably that is the price she has to pay. She never married. She never loved, and so never fulfilled her role. One cannot ever have everything. Probably she has to pay. After all, what difference does it make if she occasionally gets these attacks of indigestion? I get it occasionally. You do too, probably, and not for physical reasons, as you may know. One gets headaches. In other words, it is not so much a question as to whether we are able to cure a patient, whether we can or not, but whether we should or not. No organismic life can be straightforwardly self-expansive in all directions. Each one must draw back into himself in some areas, pay some penalty of a severe kind for his natural fears and limitations. It is all right to say, with Adler, that mental illness is due to problems in living, but we must remember that life itself is the insurmountable problem. This is not to say that psychotherapy cannot give great gifts to tortured and overwhelmed people, and even added dignity to anyone who values and can use self-knowledge. Psychotherapy can allow people to affirm themselves, to smash idols that constrict the self-esteem, to lift the load of neurotic guilt, the extra guilt piled on top of natural existential guilt. It can clear away neurotic despair, the despair that comes from a too constricted focus for one's safety and satisfactions. When a person becomes less fragmented, less blocked and bottled up, he does experience real joy, the joy of finding more of himself, of the release from armor and binding reflexes, of throwing off the chains of uncritical and self-defeating dependency, of controlling his own energies, of discovering aspects of the world, intense experience in the present moment, that is now freer of prefixed perceptions, new possibilities of choice and action, and so on. Yes, psychotherapy can do all these things, but there are many things that it cannot do, and they have not been aired widely enough. Often psychotherapy seems to promise the moon, a more constant joy, delight, celebration of life, perfect love, and perfect freedom. It seems to promise that these things are easy to come by once self-knowledge is achieved, that they are things that should and could characterize one's whole waking awareness. As one patient said, who had just undergone a course in primal scream therapy, "I feel so fantastic and wonderful, but this is only a beginning. Wait till you see me in 5 years. It'll be tremendous." We can only hope that she won't be too unhappy. Not everyone is as honest as Freud was when he said that he cured the miseries of the neurotic, only to open him up to the normal misery of life. Only angels know unrelieved joy, or are able to stand it. Yet we see the books by the mind healers with their garish titles, Joy, Awakening, and the like. We see them in person in lecture halls or in groups, beaming their peculiar brand of inward, confident well-being, so that it communicates its unmistakable message. We can do this for you, too, if you will only let us. I have never seen or heard them communicate the dangers of the total liberation that they claim to offer. Say, to put up a small sign next to the one advertising joy, carrying some inscription like, Danger, Real Probability of the Awakening of Terror and Dread, from which there is no turning back. It would be honest, and would also relieve them of some of the guilt of the occasional suicide that takes place in therapy. But it would also be most difficult to take the straightforward prescription for paradise on earth and make it ambiguous. One cannot be a functioning prophet with a message that he half takes back, especially if he needs paying customers and devoted admirers. The psychotherapists are caught up in contemporary culture and are forced to be a part of it. Commercial industrialism promised Western man a paradise on earth, described in great detail by the Hollywood myth, that replaced the paradise in heaven of the Christian myth. And now psychology must replace them both with the myth of paradise through self-knowledge. This is the promise of psychology, and for the most part, the psychotherapists are obliged to live it and embody it. But it was Rank who saw how false this claim is. Psychology as self-knowledge is self-deception, he said, because it does not give what men want, which is immortality. Nothing could be plainer. When the patient emerges from his protective cocoon, he gives up the reflexive immortality ideology that he has lived under, both in its personal parental form, living in the protective powers of the parents or their surrogates, and in its cultural causa sui form, living by the opinions of others, and in the symbolic role dramatization of the society. What new immortality ideology can the self-knowledge of psychotherapy provide to replace this? Obviously none from psychology, unless, said Rank, psychology itself becomes the new belief system. Now there are only three ways, I think, that psychology itself can become an adequate belief system. One of them is to be a creative genius as a psychologist, and to use psychology as the immortality vehicle for oneself, as Freud and subsequent psychoanalysts have done. Another is to use the language and concepts of psychotherapy in much of one's waking life, so that it becomes a lived belief system. We see this often as ex-patients analyze their motives in all situations when they feel anxious. This must be penis envy. This must be incestuous attraction, castration fear, Oedipal rivalry, polymorphous perversity, and so on. I met one young person who was nearly driven crazy and perverse trying to live the motivational vocabulary of the new Freudian religion. But in a way, this attitude is forced, because religion is an experience and not merely a set of intellectual concepts to meditate on. It has to be lived. As the psychologist Paul Bacon penetratingly remarked, this is one of the reasons that psychotherapy has moved away from the Freudian intellectual model to the new experiential model. If psychology is to be the modern religion, then it has to reflect lived experience. It has to move away from mere talking and intellectual analysis to the actual screaming out of the traumas of birth and childhood, the acting out of dreams and hostility, and so on. What this does is to make the hour of psychotherapy itself a ritual experience, an initiation, a holy excursion into a tabooed and sacred realm. The patient imbibes another dimension of life, one previously unknown to him and unsuspected by him. Truly a mystery religion, separate from the everyday secular world. He engages in behaviors that are very esoteric and permit the expression of aspects of his personality that he never thought of expressing or even imagined that he had. As in any religion, the adept swears by it because he has lived it. The therapy is true because it is a lived experience explained by concepts that seem perfectly to fit it, that give form to what the patient actually is undergoing. The third and final way is merely an extension and sophistication of this. It is to take psychology and deepen it with religious and metaphysical associations so that it becomes actually a religious belief system with some breadth and depth. At the same time, the psychotherapist himself beams out the steady and quiet power of transference and becomes the guru figure of the religion. No wonder we are seeing such a proliferation of psychological gurus in our time. It is the perfect and logical development of the fetishization of psychology as a belief system. It extends that system into its necessary dimension, which is immortality and the life-enhancing power that goes with it. This power comes in two forms, from the concepts of the religion, and concretely from the person of the guru therapist. It is no coincidence that one of the very popular forms of therapy today, called Gestalt therapy, for the most part, ignores the problem of transference, as though one can shoo it away by turning one's back on it. Actually, what is happening is that the aura of guru infallibility remains intact and provides an automatic shelter for the patient's deep yearnings for safety and security. It is no accident either that the therapists who practice these guru therapies cultivate themselves with halo-like beards and hairdos to look the part they play. I am not implying dishonesty here at all, merely that men tend to get caught up in the appropriateness of the panoplies they use and need. If one senses therapeutic religion as a cultural need, then it is the highest idealism to try and fill that need with one's heart and soul. On the other hand, even with the best intentions, transference is, willy-nilly, a process of indoctrination. Many psychoanalysts, as we know, try very conscientiously to analyze the transference. Others try to minimize it. Despite the best efforts, the patient usually becomes in some way a slavish admirer of the man and the techniques of his liberation, however small it is. We already know that one of the reasons that Freud's influence on ideas was so great was that many of the leading thinkers of our time underwent Freudian analysis, and so came away with a personal, emotional stake in the Freudian worldview. This book is continued on Disc 10. The Denial of Death, by Ernest Becker. Continued. Disc 10. The thing about transference is that it takes root very subtly, all the while that the person seems to be squarely on his own feet. A person can be indoctrinated into a worldview that he comes to believe without suspecting that he may have embraced it, because of his relationship to a therapist or a master. We find this in very subtle form in those therapies that seek to put man back into contact with his own authentic self, meaning the pristine powers that are locked inside him. The person is enjoined to try to tap these powers, this inside of nature, to dig down deeply into the subjectivity of his organism. The theory is that as one progressively peels away the social facade, the character defenses, the unconscious anxieties, he then gets down to his real self, the source of vitality and creativity behind the neurotic shield of character. In order to make psychology a complete belief system, all the therapist has to do is to borrow words for the inner depths of the personality from traditional mystical religions. It can be called variously the great void, the inner room of Taoism, the realm of essence, the source of things, the it, the creative unconscious, or whatever. The whole thing seems very logical, factual, and true to nature. Man peels away his armor and unfolds his inner self, primal energies from the ground of his being in which he takes root. The person is, after all, not his own creator. He is sustained at all times by the workings of his physiochemistry, and beneath that, of his atomic and subatomic structure. These structures contain within themselves the immense powers of nature, and so it seems logical to say that we are being constantly created and sustained out of the invisible void. How can one be betrayed by therapy if he is being brought back to primary realities? It is obvious from techniques like Zen that the initiation into the world of the it takes place by a process of breakdown and reintegration. This process is much like Western therapy, wherein the mask of society is peeled away and the drivenness is relaxed. In Zen, however, it is the primal powers that now are supposed to take over, to act through the person as he opens himself up for them. He becomes their tool and their vehicle. In Zen archery, for example, the archer no longer himself shoots the arrow at the target, but it shoots. The interior of nature erupts into the world through the disciple's perfect selflessness and releases the string. First, the disciple has to go through a long process of attuning himself to his own interior, which takes place by means of a long subjection to a master, to whom one remains a lifelong disciple, a convert to his worldview. If the disciple is lucky, he will even get from the master one of his bows, which contains his personal spirit powers. The transference is sealed in a concrete gift. From all Hindu discipleship, too, the person comes away with a master without whom, usually, he is lost and cannot function. He needs the master himself periodically, or his picture, or his messages through the mail, or at least the exact technique that the master used, the headstands, the breathing, and so on. These become the fetishized magical means of recapturing the power of the transference figure, so that when one does them, all is well. The disciple can now stand on his own feet, be his own person. The fusion of psychology and religion is thus not only logical, it is necessary if the religion is to work. There is no way of standing on one's own center without outside support, only now this support is made to seem to come from the inside. The person is conditioned to function under his own control, from his own center, from the spiritual powers that well up within him. Actually, of course, the support comes from the transference certification by the guru that what the disciple is doing is true and good. Even reconditioning body therapies like that of the once-noted F.M. Alexander today liberally sprinkle their therapy with ideas from Zen and cite their affinity to people like Gurdjieff. There seems no way to get the body to reintegrate without giving it some kind of magical sustaining power. At least there is no better way to win full discipleship to a religion than by making it frankly religious. It is no wonder that when therapies strip man down to his naked aloneness, to the real nature of experience and the problem of life, they slip into some kind of metaphysic of power and justification from beyond. How can the person be left there trembling and alone? Offer him the possibility of mystical contact with the void of creation, the power of it, his likeness to God, or at the very least the support of a guru who will vouch for these things in his own overpowering and harmonious appearing person. Man must reach out for support to a dream, a metaphysic of hope that sustains him and makes his life worthwhile. To talk about hope is to give the right focus to the problem. It helps us understand why even the thinkers of great stature, who got at the heart of human problems, could not rest content with the view of the tragical nature of man's lot that this knowledge gives. It is today well known how Wilhelm Reich continued the Enlightenment in the direction of fusion of Freud with Marxist social criticism, only to reach finally for Orgon, the primal cosmic energy, or how Jung wrote an intellectual apologia for the text of ancient Chinese magic, the I Ching. In this, as Reif has so bitingly argued, these men are of lesser stature than their master, the great Stoic Freud. The Limits of Human Nature. In our earlier discussion of what is possible for man, we said that a person is stuck with his character, that he can't evolve beyond it or without it. If there is a limit to what man can be, we now also must conclude that there is a limit even to what religious therapy can do for him. But the psychotherapeutic religionists are claiming just the opposite, that the life force can miraculously emerge from nature, can transcend the body it uses as a vehicle, and can break the bounds of human character. They claim that man, as he now is, can be merely a vehicle for the emergence of something totally new, a vehicle that can be transcended by a new form of human life. Many of the leading figures in modern thought slip into some such mystique, some eschatology of immanence, in which the insides of nature will erupt into a new being. Jung wrote such an argument in his Answer to Job. The answer to the laments of Job was that man's condition would not always be the same because a new man would break out of the womb of creation. Eric Fromm once lamented that it is a wonder that more people are not insane since life is such a terrible burden. And then he went on to write a book with the title, You Shall Be as Gods. Gods verging on insanity, one must assume. Fortunately, there is no need for us to take up the metaphysical aspects of this problem. It is now the center of a passionate and at the same time coolly intellectual review by some of our best critical minds, not only by Reif, but also by Lionel Trilling, and now John Passmore, in an important historical critical work. It can all be summed up in the simplest and sharpest terms. How can an ego-controlled animal change his structure? How can a self-conscious creature change the dilemma of his existence? There is simply no way to transcend the limits of the human condition, or to change the psychological structural conditions that make humanity possible. What can it mean for something new to emerge from such an animal, and to triumph over his nature? Even though men have repeated such a notion since the most ancient times, and in the most subtle and weightiest ways, even though whole movements of social action as well as thought have been inspired by such ideas, still they are mere fancy, as Passmore has so well reminded us. I myself have been fond of using ideas like the developing spirit of man and the promise of new birth, but I don't think I ever meant them to conjure up a new creature. Rather, I was thinking more of new birth bringing new adaptations, new creative solutions to our problems, a new openness in dealing with stale perceptions about reality, new forms of art, music, literature, architecture, that would be a continual transformation of reality. But behind it all would be the same type of evolutionary creature, making his own peculiar responses to a world that continued to transcend him. Note: Philip Reif sobered me up about my loose use of ideas of immanence during a panel exchange a couple of years ago. In a characteristically honest and dramatic way, he admitted that he was like everyone else, a part man, and he enjoined the audience to admit that we all were, asking what it could possibly mean to be a whole man. End of note. If psychotherapists and scientists lapse into metaphysics so easily, we should not blame theologians for doing the same. But ironically, theologians today are often the most sober about immanence and its possibilities. Consider Paul Tillich. He too had his metaphysic of new being, the belief in the emergence of a new type of person who would be more in harmony with nature, less driven, more perceptive, more in touch with his own creative energies, and who might go on to form genuine communities to replace the collectivities of our time, communities of truer persons in place of the objective creatures created by our materialistic culture. But Tillich had fewer illusions about this new being than most of the psychotherapeutic religionists. He saw that the idea was actually a myth, an ideal that might be worked toward, and so partly realized. It was not a fixed truth about the insides of nature. This point is crucial. As he so honestly put it, the only argument for the truth of this gospel of new being is that the message makes itself true. Or, as we would say in the science of man, it is an ideal typical enjoinder. I think the whole question of what is possible for the inner self of man was nicely summed up by Suzanne Langer in the phrase, the myth of the inner life. She used this term in reference to the experience of music, but it seems to apply to the whole metaphysic of the unconscious, of the emergence of new energies from the heart of nature. But let us quickly add that this use of the term myth is not meant to be disparaging or to reflect simple illusion. As Langer explained, some myths are vegetative. They generate real conceptual power, real apprehension of a dim truth, some kind of global adumbration of what we miss by sharp analytic reason. Most of all, as William James and Tillich have argued, beliefs about reality affect people's real actions. They help introduce the new into the world. Especially is this true for beliefs about man, about human nature, and about what man may yet become. If something influences our efforts to change the world, then to some extent it must change that world. This helps explain one of the things that perplex us about psychoanalytic prophets like Eric Fromm. We wonder how they can so easily forget about the dilemmas of the human condition that tragically limit man's efforts. The answer is, on one level, that they have to leave tragedy behind as a part of a program to awaken some kind of hopeful creative effort by men. Fromm has nicely argued the Deweyan thesis that as reality is partly the result of human effort, the person who prides himself on being a hard-headed realist and refrains from hopeful action is really abdicating the human task. This accent on human effort, vision, and hope, in order to help shape reality, seems to me largely to exonerate Fromm from the charges that he really is a rabbi at heart, who is impelled to redeem man and cannot let the world be. If the alternative is fatalistic acceptance of the present human condition, then each of us is a rabbi, or had better be. But once we say this, once we make a pragmatic argument for creative myth, it does not let us off the hook so easily about the nature of the real world. It only makes us more uncomfortable with the therapeutic religionists. If you are going to have a myth of new being, then like Tillich, you have to use this myth as a call to the highest and most difficult effort, and not to simple joy. A creative myth is not simply a relapse into comfortable illusion. It has to be as bold as possible in order to be truly generative. What singles out Tillich's cogitations about the new being is that there is no nonsense here. Tillich means that man has to live the courage to be himself, to stand on his own feet, to face up to the eternal contradictions of the real world. The bold goal of this kind of courage is to absorb into one's own being the maximum amount of non-being. As a being, as an extension of all of being, man has an organismic impulsion to take into his own organization the maximum amount of the problematic of life. His daily life, then, becomes truly a duty of cosmic proportions, and his courage to face the anxiety of meaninglessness becomes a true cosmic heroism. No longer does one do as God wills, set over against some imaginary figure in heaven. Rather, in one's own person, he tries to achieve what the creative powers of emergent being have themselves so far achieved with lower forms of life, the overcoming of that which would negate life. The problem of meaninglessness is the form in which non-being poses itself in our time. Then, says Tillich, the task of conscious beings at the height of their evolutionary destiny is to meet and vanquish this new emergent obstacle to sentient life. In this kind of ontology of immanence of the new being, what we are describing is not a creature who is transformed and who transforms the world in turn in some miraculous ways, but rather a creature who takes more of the world into himself and develops new forms of courage and endurance. It is not very different from the Athenian ideal as expressed in Oedipus, or from what it meant to Kant to be a man. At least, this is the ideal for a new kind of man. It shows why Tillich's myth of being truly centered on one's own energies is a radical one. It points to all the evasions of centeredness in man, always being part of something or someone else, sheltering oneself in alien powers. Transference, even after we admit its necessary and ideal dimensions, reflects some universal betrayal of man's own powers, which is why he is always submerged by the large structures of society. He contributes to the very things that enslave him. The critique of guru therapies also comes to rest here. You can't talk about an ideal of freedom in the same breath that you willingly give it up. This fact turned Kessler against the East, just as it also led Tillich to argue so penetratingly that Eastern mysticism is not for Western man. It is an evasion of the courage to be. It prevents the absorption of maximum meaninglessness into oneself. Note, I think Tillich failed to see through one idol in his search for the courage to be. He seems to have liked the idea of the collective unconscious because it expressed the dimension of the inner depth of being and might be an access to the realm of essence. This seems to me a surprising lapse from his customary soberness. How could the ground of being be as accessible as Jung imagined? It seems to me that this concept would destroy the whole idea of the fall. How can man have the realm of essence on tap, so to speak? And if he does, doesn't Tillich's understanding of grace lose all its meaning as a pure gift beyond human effort? End of note. Tillich's point is that mystical experience seems to be near to perfect faith, but is not. Mysticism lacks precisely the element of skepticism, and skepticism is a more radical experience, a more manly confrontation of potential meaninglessness. Even more, we must not forget that much of the time, mysticism as popularly practiced is fused with a sense of magical omnipotence. It is actually a manic defense and a denial of creatureliness. Again, we are talking about the highest ideal things, which always seem most unreal. But how can we settle for less? We need the boldest creative myths, not only to urge men on, but also, and perhaps especially, to help men see the reality of their condition. We have to be as hard-headed as possible about reality and possibility. From this point of view, we can see that the therapeutic revolution raises two great problems. The first is how mature, critical, and sober these new liberated people will be. How much have they pushed in the direction of genuine freedom? How much have they avoided the real world and its problems, their own bitter paradoxes? How much have they hedged on their liberation by still holding on to others, to illusions, or to certainties? If the Freudian revolution in modern thought can mean anything at all, it must be that it brings to birth a new level of introspection, as well as social criticism. We already see these reflected not only in academic intellectual awareness, but also even in the popular mind, in the letters and advice columns of mass circulation newspapers. Where, 35 years ago, could you read an advice to the lovelorn that cautioned a girl against her boyfriend who refused for moral reasons to make love to her as she asked him to, because he might be projecting onto her his own impotence? But this brings up the second great problem raised by the therapeutic revolution, namely, so what? Even with numerous groups of really liberated people at their best, we can't imagine that the world will be any pleasanter or less tragic a place. It may even be worse in still unknown ways. As Tillich warned us, new being, under the conditions and limitations of existence, will only bring into play new and sharper paradoxes, new tensions and more painful disharmonies, a more intense demonism. Reality is remorseless because gods do not walk upon the earth, and if men could become noble repositories of great gulfs of non-being, they would have even less peace than we oblivious and driven madmen have today. Besides, can any ideal of therapeutic revolution touch the vast masses of this globe, the modern mechanical men in Russia, the near billion sheep-like followers in China, the brutalized and ignorant populations of almost every continent? When one lives in the liberation atmosphere of Berkeley, California, or in the intoxications of small doses of unconstriction in a therapeutic group in one's hometown, one is living in a hothouse atmosphere that shuts out the reality of the rest of the planet, the way things really are in this world. It is this therapeutic megalomania that must quickly be seen through if we are not to be perfect fools. The empirical facts of the world will not fade away because one has analyzed his Oedipus complex, as Freud so well knew, or because one can make love with tenderness, as so many now believe. Forget it. In this sense, again, it is Freud's somber pessimism, especially of his later writings, such as Civilization and Its Discontents, that keeps him so contemporary. Men are doomed to live in an overwhelmingly tragic and demonic world. The fusion of science and religion. Therapeutic religion will never replace traditional religions with the messages of Judaism, most of Christianity, Buddhism, and the like. They have held that man is doomed to his present form, that he can't really evolve any further, that anything he might achieve can only be achieved from within the real nightmare of his loneliness in creation, and from the energies that he now has. He has to adapt and wait. New birth will keep him going, give him constant renewal, say the Christians. And if he has perfect righteousness and faith, and enough of it spread widely enough among his fellows, then, say the Hebrews, God himself will act. Men should wait, while using their best intelligence and effort, to secure their adaptation and survival. Ideally, they would wait in a condition of openness toward miracle and mystery, in the lived truth of creation, which would make it easier both to survive and to be redeemed, because men would be less driven to undo themselves and would be more like the image that pleases their Creator, awe-filled creatures trying to live in harmony with the rest of creation. Today, we would add, too, that they would be less likely to poison the rest of creation. What do we mean by the lived truth of creation? We have to mean the world as it appears to men in a condition of relative unrepression, that is, as it would appear to creatures who assess their true puniness in the face of the overwhelmingness and majesty of the universe, of the unspeakable miracle of even the single created object, as it probably appeared to the earliest men on the planet, and to those extrasensitive types who have filled the roles of shaman, prophet, saint, poet, and artist. What is unique about their perception of reality is that it is alive to the panic inherent in creation. Sylvia Plath somewhere named God King Panic, and panic is fittingly king of the grotesque. What are we to make of a creation in which the routine activity is for organisms to be tearing others apart with teeth of all types, biting, grinding flesh, plant stalks, bones between molars, pushing the pulp greedily down the gullet with delight, incorporating its essence into one's own organization, and then excreting with foul stench and gases the residue. Everyone reaching out to incorporate others who are edible to him. The mosquitoes bloating themselves on blood, the maggots, the killer bees attacking with a fury and a demonism, sharks continuing to tear and swallow while their own innards are being torn out. Not to mention the daily dismemberment and slaughter in natural accidents of all types. An earthquake buries alive 70,000 bodies in Peru. Automobiles make a pyramid heap of over 50,000 a year in the U.S. alone. A tidal wave washes over 250,000 in the Indian Ocean. Creation is a nightmare spectacular, taking place on a planet that has been soaked for hundreds of millions of years in the blood of all its creatures. The soberest conclusion that we could make about what has actually been taking place on the planet for about 3 billion years is that it is being turned into a vast pit of fertilizer. But the sun distracts our attention, always baking the blood dry, making things grow over it, and with its warmth giving the hope that comes with the organism's comfort and expansiveness. Questo somarde, e questo min amore, as Michelangelo put it. Science and religion merge in a critique of the deadening of perception of this kind of truth, and science betrays us when it is willing to absorb lived truth all into itself. Here the criticism of all behaviorist psychology, all manipulations of men, and all coercive utopianism comes to rest. These techniques try to make the world other than it is, legislate the grotesque out of it, inaugurate a proper human condition. The psychologist Kenneth Clark, in his recent presidential address to the American Psychological Association, called for a new kind of chemical to deaden man's aggressiveness and so make the world a less dangerous place. The Watsons, the Skinners, the Pavlovians, all have their formulas for smoothing things out. Even Freud, Enlightenment man that he was, after all, wanted to see a saner world and seemed willing to absorb lived truth into science if only it were possible. He once mused that in order to really change things by therapy, one would have to get at the masses of men, and that the only way to do this would be to mix the copper of suggestion into the pure gold of psychoanalysis. In other words, to coerce by transference a less evil world. But Freud knew better, as he gradually came to see that the evil in the world is not only in the insides of people, but on the outside, in nature, which is why he became more realistic and pessimistic in his later work. The problem with all the scientific manipulators is that somehow they don't take life seriously enough. In this sense, all science is bourgeois, an affair of bureaucrats. I think that taking life seriously means something such as this, that whatever man does on this planet has to be done in the lived truth of the terror of creation, of the grotesque, of the rumble of panic underneath everything. Otherwise, it is false. Whatever is achieved must be achieved from within the subjective energies of creatures, without deadening, with the full exercise of passion, of vision, of pain, of fear, and of sorrow. How do we know, with Rilke, that our part of the meaning of the universe might not be a rhythm in sorrow? Manipulative utopian science, by deadening human sensitivity, would also deprive men of the heroic in their urge to victory. And we know that in some very important way this falsifies our struggle by emptying us, by preventing us from incorporating the maximum of experience. It means the end of the distinctively human, or even, we must say, the distinctively organismic. In the mysterious way in which life is given to us in evolution on this planet, it pushes in the direction of its own expansion. We don't understand it simply because we don't know the purpose of creation. We only feel life straining in ourselves and see it thrashing others about as they devour each other. Life seeks to expand in an unknown direction for unknown reasons. Not even psychology should meddle with this sacrosanct vitality, concluded Rank. This is the meaning of his option for the irrational as the basis for life. It is an option based on empirical experience. There is a driving force behind a mystery that we cannot understand, and that includes more than reason alone. The urge to cosmic heroism, then, is sacred and mysterious, and not to be neatly ordered and rationalized by science and secularism. Science, after all, is a credo that has attempted to absorb into itself and to deny the fear of life and death, and it is only one more competitor in the spectrum of roles for cosmic heroics. Modern man is drinking and drugging himself out of awareness, or he spends his time shopping, which is the same thing. As awareness calls for types of heroic dedication that his culture no longer provides for him, society contrives to help him forget. Or alternatively, he buries himself in psychology in the belief that awareness all by itself will be some kind of magical cure for his problems. But psychology was born with the breakdown of shared social heroisms. It can only be gone beyond with the creation of new heroisms that are basically matters of belief and will, dedication to a vision. Lifton has recently concluded the same thing from a conceptual point of view almost identical to Rank's. When a thinker of Norman Brown stature wrote his later book, Love's Body, he was led to take his thought to this same point. He realized that the only way to get beyond the natural contradictions of existence was in the time-worn religious way, to project one's problems onto a God figure, to be healed by an all-embracing and all-justifying beyond. To talk in these terms is not at all the same thing as to talk the language of the psychotherapeutic religionists. Rank was not so naive nor so messianic. He saw that the orientation of men has to be always beyond their bodies, has to be grounded in healthy repressions and toward explicit immortality ideologies, myths of heroic transcendence. Note. It is worth noting that Brown's final point of arrival is the logically correct one, but I personally find his later book very unsatisfying. One wonders why he has to present his new position in such a barrage of aphorisms, such a turbulent hodgepodge of half-veiled thoughts, terse in the extreme and often cryptic, only to end up in a mystical Christianity of the oldest vintage, and a call for the final judgment day. In this, at least, his later book is entirely consistent with the earlier one. Natural existence and the frustrating limitations of the body calls for total all-or-nothing relief, either in unrepression or at last in the end of the world. End of note. We can conclude that a project as grand as the scientific mythical construction of victory over human limitation is not something that can be programmed by science. Even more, it comes from the vital energies of masses of men sweating within the nightmare of creation, and that is not even in man's hands to program. Who knows what form the forward momentum of life will take in the time ahead, or what use it will make of our anguished searching? The most that any one of us can seem to do is to fashion something, an object or ourselves, and drop it into the confusion, make an offering of it, so to speak, to the life force. This concludes the reading of The Denial of Death by Ernest Becker. This book was read by Raymond Todd. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Free Press, a division of Simon & Schuster, Incorporated, and was produced in 2005 by Blackstone Audio Books, Incorporated, which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio Books. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.